Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 299, I chat with Juan Reyes of My Eye Media about the challenges of quality control testing of content in the digital age. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded April 7th, 2016. Episode 299, The Challenges of Content Testing. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by CuriosityStream, a subscription streaming service that offers over 1,300 documentaries and non-fiction series from the world's best filmmakers. Get unlimited access starting at just $2.99 a month. And for our audience, the first 2 months are completely free if you sign up at curiositystream.com/TWIT and use the promo code TWIT. And by Epson's new EcoTank printers. With Epson's line of SuperTank all-in-one printers, you can print thousands of documents without running out of ink. EcoTank is loaded and ready to print when you are. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank to find out more. Hi there, Scott Wilkinson here, the home theater geek and editor of AVSForum.com. This week's guest geek is Juan Reyes, Chief Innovation Officer at My Eye Media, a content testing company right here in Los Angeles. Hey, Juan, welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott, thanks for having me.
So nice to have you here. This is actually your second appearance. You were here when you worked for a company called Blue Focus, but you recently changed jobs and you're doing some really interesting stuff. So I'm sure glad to have you here to talk about what's up with you these days. Before we get to it, though, I want to make sure everybody knows that those who are tuned in live at live.twit.tv and logged into the chat room there or at irc.twit.tv can post questions as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. It always helps if you use my screen name, which is my full name, Scott Wilkinson, no dots or dashes or spaces, because then your question or comment appears in a different color on my screen, and my eye will be drawn more immediately to it. So, Juan, let's start by having you tell us what My Eye Media does.
Sure. So, My Eye Media is a testing facility based out of Burbank, California, with offices also in New York and Tokyo, and a distributed workforce located around the world. So primarily what we do here is we provide a variety of testing services for home entertainment customers, studios, OTT platforms. But basically, we're testing the content that is being released before it's actually making it to the consumer's homes, whether it is the mezzanine files that are the high level of the master file before it actually goes through the entire production process, all the way down to the optical media products for DVD, for Blu-ray, and then what's coming out of the streaming provider's boxes, like, let's say, a Netflix, and what's going into the consumer's home. So throughout the entire chain, we're involved in testing it to make sure that is of the, you know, the best possible quality. There's no issues with how the content appears, no issues with any of the requirements of the content, frame rate, et cetera. So there's a variety of things that we go through to ensure that the content is exactly what the content owner or the platform wants and that it is a good viewing experience for the consumer.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell us who some of your clients are, or is that a secret?
We work for a lot of the major Hollywood studios and a lot of the online platforms, companies such as Netflix. We do work with, HBO, Disney, and you know, several others.
Mm. And what about your facilities? I would love to see, and I think we have some photographs here to show what your facilities look like to show people kind of behind the scenes where it is and that you actually do this very important work.
Yeah, so we have a 20,000 square foot facility located here in Burbank, We've invested quite a bit into the facility, making sure we have an extremely fast and robust digital infrastructure, making sure we have a very fast connection to our clients. All the clients we work directly with, we have a 1 gig connection going directly to them. Professional bays that we're using to conduct all of our video and audio QC, have them set up to support, you know, the latest and greatest codecs from Dolby supporting Atmos and DTS supporting DTSX. So we always want to make sure we have the latest and greatest in regards to not only the professional gear and tools that are needed for the work we do, but also the consumer type of environments, the consumer receivers, the consumer displays, the consumer, you know, media receivers, set-top box, Blu-ray players, Ultra HD Blu-ray players, all of that information, so that essentially we can be that one-stop shop for any type of testing of any home entertainment product before it gets out to the consumer.
Yeah, I'm interested in particular in the consumer displays that you have there. I mean, you're looking at 4K or UHD content, right? And I assume a high dynamic range or HDR content as well, right?
Oh, absolutely. That's something we've been working on for quite some time. And it's something that's pretty exciting because it's something really new to home entertainment, the ability to extend beyond what we used to have with HD, the wider color gamut, the high dynamic range, all of that. So making sure we have the latest and greatest in regards to the displays from a variety of different manufacturers so we can see how things are performing. I mean, the HDR displays really weren't introduced into the market for consumers until last year. So we're dealing with a lot of first and second generation products. And as you know, anytime you're dealing with new technology, that first and second generation, there's a lot of, you know, trial and error, and you come across some, you know, some interesting things. So our job is to make sure we have all of that so we can determine, you know, what could be happening from one manufacturer to another, or even from one model to another, and work very closely with the manufacturers of the devices, the content owners, the people creating the content, so that when an issue is identified, we can help to kind of be the interface between all of the groups and determine, you know, what might be the problem, if any new tests need to be created, new firmware needs to be applied. We can, you know, kind of help to rectify all of that and work through it with everyone involved.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that would be a particular challenge to, if you're looking at a piece of content on a first or second generation display, say, which is all you can do now, and you come across a problem, how do you determine if it's in the content or if it's in the display, if it's a problem with the firmware or the decoding or something like that?
And that's where having a variety of equipment is essential. So having different displays with similar capabilities from the same manufacturer, from different manufacturers. Obviously, if the issue is occurring on all of the different displays, then you know it could be something related to the content. But at the same time, what if it is the playback device that's causing the issue and it's not the content? Mm-hmm. So then you'll want to go ahead, and once you determine it's not something on the display side, let's try a different player and see if it might be player specific. You find that the same issue is happening on the player, then you know it's something on the content side, and then just report it accordingly. So we kind of help to pinpoint the problem, which really helps to expedite the solution from the content creators and the content owners, so they don't have to go and, you know, spin their wheels.
Mm-hmm. Well, with streaming, there are a couple of different companies now that stream. Content providers that stream UHD and HDR content, and also a couple of different, aren't that many boxes. Maybe there are no outboard boxes that stream HDR. You can only get that through a TV app.
Right, exactly. A lot of that now is centered on the application and the display being enabled to support 4K and or HDR content. So you don't really, as of yet, have a lot of the, you know, the ability to have that set-top box, whether it's some type of a, you know, a media receiver or a UHD Blu-ray player that might have, you know, that type of app built in and output it. Primarily, it's been built into the displays.
Mm-hmm. Another reason for you to have a bunch of different makes and models of displays so that you can test this content on a variety of them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have one of the key factors for HDR is the luminance level, which typically is measured in nits. You know, what does it look like on a 1,000 nit display? What does it look like on a 400 or an 800 nit display or a 4K display that just does SDR? So you can determine if there's any issues with the different types of display capabilities that are out there, or if there's something maybe specific to a display, not properly tone mapping the content. The idea is putting it into as many scenarios as possible, especially right now when the technology is so brand new and there's always that issue that, you know, hey, we didn't think that that could happen, but it could happen. So our job is to try to find those types of issues and report them and help to work with all the groups involved in the creation of the content and the devices to help rectify those.
Mm-hmm. It's certainly a different situation than standard dynamic range, high definition, where the peak brightness was well-defined, the color gamut was well-defined, everything was very well-defined. Now in HDR, everything is not so well-defined. I mean, there are people working towards, making those definitions clearer, but TVs can have a variety of different capabilities in terms of peak luminance, in terms of color gamut. And so I'm sure a lot of what you do, and I'd love for you to talk about this a little more in detail, has to do with how does the TV, as you said before, tone map or remap the content coming in based upon how it was created to what the individual TV's capability is, which is going to be different than the next TV's capabilities.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, you could be looking at content on one display. You could have two, 800 displays on one of them. You know, the picture looks great on another one. All of a sudden, you're looking at the reds being overly saturated or the color appearing as it's clipping. So obviously, you know, there could be something specific to the display's performance. There's a lot of capabilities that are available to the displays. Like you said, the wide color gamut, the brightness, the nit level. But a lot of that information, though, isn't really being, clearly communicated. You know, you go to the website of the displays that support HDR. Some of them are now starting to indicate, yes, we support HDR, but, 6 months ago, you'd have a HDR display, but no information to say, yes, it is HDR, or what is the maximum luminance in nits for it. Even that information it's hard to find. You have to kind of research articles that have, been written by people who are doing testing of the displays, or reaching out to, people within the display manufacturers who might have information that, they could disclose for you. Of course, we do have one of the groups now, the Ultra HD Alliance is working to get displays available with very specific, performance requirements. They've developed a program for their, Ultra HD premium, certification level where you have, 1,000 nits or higher for a HDR display. For the OLEDs, that's at 540 nits or higher. Then you have for the black levels, you're looking at that too, making sure that, they can hit a point, I think it's 0.005, and then for an OLED, a 0.0005. So these very specific requirements. So if you see a display that has that Ultra HD, premium logo on it, for a fact that they at least meet those particular performance requirements. And the same thing on the color space, which although we have the ability for UHD to get into the BT2020 color space, right now a lot of the display manufacturers aren't quite to that level. So they're kind of looking more towards the P3 color space and, the Ultra HD Alliance, their specification has it to where you can, want to make sure that the display can meet that particular performance level within a certain tolerance.
But even the, and I agree with you that the UHD Alliance Ultra HD premium specification goes some way towards quantifying and defining what HDR performance really means or should be, at least at some level. There are those who are arguing that the testing procedure established by the Ultra HD Alliance might not be as clear-cut as it could be. I mean, we know from several articles online that Vizio, for example, has decided not to apply for Ultra HD premium certification with its new P series. You used to work for Blue Focus, which is one of the testing facilities for UHD premium. And I know you don't work there anymore and you can't really talk about what they're doing. But from a general perspective, do you think that Ultra HD premium specifications are reasonable? Going forward, are they really meaningful is what I'm asking.
Well, Scott, the Ultra HD Alliance has spent a lot of time working with a lot of the different groups involved in the we'll call it the HDR ecosystem, the content owners, the content developers, the display manufacturers, to develop something that would provide consumers with a very, very high level of performance on the displays when displaying HDR content. So it's not something that they took lightly. Over time, many more manufacturers came on board, many more content owners came on board to really look very closely at what was the Ultra HD premium, you know, requirement performance from the performance level going to be. So, and again, it was just announced, as you know, at CES this last year, which is, you know, just what, three months ago.
3 months ago, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it's very new. And like with any standard certification, they will, you know, things will evolve and things will change. And you know, I'm sure you'll probably see, you know, enhancements to it. But from the performance we've seen from the displays that are certified, you get a very, very high performance, great quality from content that also carries the same, you know, Ultra HD premium logo. You know, and that's not to say that there aren't displays out there that don't have the same, you know, performance criteria. I've read articles, I know the ones you're referring to, where some of the manufacturers do in fact boast that, you know, they meet the luminance requirements, they meet the tolerance around the color space, tone mapping, et cetera, but at this time not looking to carry that logo. And, you know, it's just a matter of educating the consumers on what is out there, what is coming. And I know the Ultra HD Alliance with the certification program has done a great job with that. I know groups like the DEG are also looking to help educate consumers around that, working with the studios, with the retailers, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So I think you're going to see a lot of advancement in this area over the next, you know, coming years. I mean, for the first time, we're able to see content in the home that is higher quality than what you can see in the theaters.
In most theaters, yes.
Most theaters.
I don't know if you live in or near Burbank. I mean, you work in Burbank, so you undoubtedly know about the AMC Dolby Cinema in
Burbank. Been there many times, yes.
It's been there many times. Good. There, I think you can really see the potential of high dynamic range.
Oh, yeah.
But there's only 14 of them, I think, in the country right now. So not very many people can actually experience that. And so I agree with you that high dynamic range televisions offer more people a way to experience this higher level of audio-video experience than we have seen before, and that you can get in most commercial cinemas. Rusty Bones in the chat room is asking, will there be a logo approval like THX certification from UHD Alliance? That's really what this is, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So as part of the announcement from the UHD Alliance, they also showed off the logo that is a part of that. So you can see it on the displays and you can see it on content as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so you're going to be dealing, your current company, MyEyeMedia, as a content evaluator, tester, will ultimately be dealing with that logo as it applies to content, right?
In regards to the logo, you know, the Ultra HD Alliance, I don't have any information in regards to the certification process specific to the content.
But
I do know... Right, exactly. But I do know that there is already content available out on the market from various studios that do in fact carry that logo. You know, you go to the store and take a look at some of the Ultra HD Blu-ray discs, you'll see on the back, the logo is typically right there on the bottom.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, good. That's great. UJ in the chat room, getting back to the whole idea of what you do, what MyEyeMedia does, says, this seems like quite a monumental task. So many variables. seems overwhelming.
It is, and that's why, you know, we need to have over 140 employees worldwide to be able to go through all the content. I mean, you know, you take a look at a movie, we'll take an Ultra HD Blu-ray disc, you know, that's going to be viewed multiple times. Every audio stream is listened to. Every subtitle stream is looked at. The video passes are done on multiple HDR displays as well as on an SDR display to ensure that the HDR to SDR down conversion is working properly on different types of players. So there are you know, in some cases, hundreds of hours that go into testing, you know, one title.
Another thing I was going to bring up was, you said you have a bunch of different displays, because I think with HDR, that's necessary because you have to see how they handle a given file stream coming in and how they map it to their own personal capabilities. But you only have one Ultra HD Blu-ray player on the market now. The Samsung player is the only one available. So unless you happen to have some prototypes or... One question that came up was, do you ever do this from a computer drive? Can Ultra HD Blu-rays be played from a computer drive, or is that not available yet? There aren't very many ways to actually play a Blu-ray, an Ultra HD Blu-ray yet.
Yeah, currently in the market, talking about the U.S. market specifically, the Samsung, the 8500 model is the one that's currently available. If you go overseas into Japan, Panasonic has their UBZ1 unit. There are some players coming out in the European regions as well. So, you know, with us and our relationships with some of the manufacturers, we're able to receive prototypes, not only the hardware players, but the software players as well. So we have been, you know, without announcing any names, able to test companies that have software players testing the Ultra HD, you know, Blu-ray content.
Ah, so there are software players on their way. You can't tell us who yet, but of course... knowing that
Correct.
It's coming is a good thing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, we've got a lot more to talk about, but before we do, I'd like to take a moment to thank our first sponsor for this episode, which is CuriosityStream, a new sponsor for Home Theater Geeks, and I'm so excited to have them with us because this is really something special. CuriosityStream is the world's first ad-free nonfiction streaming service. It was founded by John Hendricks, the founder of Discovery Communications. And Discovery, of course, is one of my favorite channels, so this is right up my alley. Currently on CuriosityStream, they have over 1,300 titles. The library has tripled in less than a year, and it's available in 196 countries worldwide. These titles are available on many different platforms, include a web app if you're looking on a computer, Roku, Android, iOS, Chromecast, Amazon Fire, Amazon Kindle, and now Apple TV. It includes a wide variety of science and technology content, perfect for the TWIT audience, and especially for me, plus nature, history, and many more topics. They have over 50 hours of 4K content, which they've just launched. It's one of the largest 4K libraries on the internet. And so, you know, tons of interesting content, really great stuff to highlight your brand new 4K TV. In addition to documentaries, they also have interviews and lectures. Their library includes a variety of things, including Stephen Hawking's Universe, a series where Stephen Hawking traces the history of astronomical theories and technology. Next World, featuring Michio Kaku, another one of my favorite scientists, talking about the future of technology, virtual reality, artificial intelligence, and other big technological questions. Hey, how about this one? The human face of big data. We're all talking about big data these days, and it's currently exclusively on CuriosityStream. Then there's The Road to the Singularity. Jason Silva and other experts explore the inevitable arrival of superhuman intelligence in this CuriosityStream original documentary. Can't wait to see that one. Now, there are monthly and annual plans available. Plans just start at just $2.99 a month, less than a cup of coffee or the cost of one title on competing on-demand platforms. Check out CuriosityStream.com/TWIT and use the promo code TWIT during sign-up to get unlimited access to the world's top documentaries and nonfiction series completely free for the first 60 days. That's two entire months free for one of the largest 4K libraries around. Just go to CuriosityStream.com/TWIT and use the code TWIT at signup. And we thank CuriosityStream very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks. I know I'll be watching a lot of CuriosityStream in the coming days and weeks because you look on that site and there's just so much cool stuff there. It's exactly what I love. So I'm talking with Juan Reyes of My Eye Media. We're talking about testing content and the challenges that are presented, especially when testing high dynamic range HDR content, which there is now a growing amount, but the standardization thereof is still a little problematic. One of the problems, Juan, I'm sure you will agree, is that we now have, for high dynamic range content, there is a maximum brightness that anything will go to. There aren't any displays really that can do that yet, 10,000 nits. So most of this content is mastered with a peak brightness of 1,000 nits or at most maybe 4,000 nits in the mastering facility. And I'm wondering if you at MyiMedia have professional mastering monitors that you look at as well, especially for the what is called the mezzanine files. And these are the files that are shuttled about within a production environment. They're much higher quality, much less compression. And then that's what's used for the editing and the grading and everything until it gets just right. And then they finally make it into a consumable format for consumers. So my question to you, Juan, is when you look at mezzanine files, are you looking at them on professional grading monitors?
You know, yeah, absolutely. That's one of the key areas that we're involved in. In fact, we recently started working in a partnership with Dolby and using some of their professional HDR monitors here at our facility to be able to test those mezzanine files using some, you know, combination of proprietary tools that Dolby has developed, tools, processes, and workflows that we've also developed and implemented here to test those mezzanine files before they get, you know, disseminated out into whatever area, into all of the different iterations that they go through before they make it out to the consumer home.
Mm-hmm. So you're testing mezzanine files. You're looking at these monitors. Mm-hmm. I assume you have the Dolby monitors. It's usually referred to as the Pulsar, 4,000 nits peak brightness. That's extremely bright.
Yeah, they have Dolby definitely has the Pulsar, the 4,000 nit that when it's turned on, the city block kind of dims a little bit.
Dims down. I'm not at all surprised. I believe it's water cooled or liquid cooled, right? It gets so hot.
Something to that effect. But they only have a handful of those that they're able to distribute literally at a handful of locations. They have come out with some additional models with a lower peak luminance capability, but still listed as their professional HDR monitors that they've provided us with here. And that's what we use for the testing that we do.
And I believe most mezzanine or most HDR files are ultimately mastered for 1,000 nits of peak brightness. I think that's right.
Well, actually, it really depends upon the content owner, their preferences, and what they decide. I think what I've been hearing and seeing is a lot of them are kind of gearing more towards the 4,000 nits, so they can kind of future-proof it so that as the technology and the displays progresses, start getting into your 1,800 nit displays, 2,000 and beyond, so that the content is future-proofed. So this way, even though you have it mastered at 4,000 nits, the display should be able to properly tone map that content so that it's taking that 4,000 nit range and converting it to whatever its own capabilities are, whether it's 1,000 nits, and then not clipping it for anything above that.
Right, and that's the big problem, isn't it? If it's mastered at 4,000 nits, it's played back at 1,000 nits. What happens to that, to stuff that's in that 1,000 to 4,000 nit range, which the mastering engineer saw and said, "Oh yeah, there's some detail in that very bright area right there." But that detail can't really be reproduced on most consumer sets. So this issue of tone mapping becomes critically important.
Yeah, it's very, very important because, as you said, you'll look at a scene of, a cloud scene, for example, and if it's tone mapped correctly in a 1,000-nit display, you'll see the blues, you'll see the grays, you see the whites. But if something is not being tone mapped properly, you'll see blues and, the whites and grays are maybe just all white or some of the blue becomes white. It just completely is just clipped and blown out.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask you about the difference, the two processes that I'm sure you must go through. One is quantitative, where you're taking measurements or actually recording some metrics of some sort, and the other being qualitative, where you mentioned that earlier, you know, you have somebody sitting and listening through all the different audio tracks and making sure that they're good. And I'm also curious to know, what are they looking for subjectively when they're looking at this content 10, 20, 30, 40 times or whatever it is. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit about objective versus subjective, quantitative versus qualitative.
Yeah. From a qualitative perspective, we're looking for whether it's 4K content, HD content, HDR. A lot of the qualitative issues are similar. You're looking for macro blocking issues, compression artifacts. You're looking for banding. You're looking for digital hits. Things that could have been the result of the encoding system, things that could have been the result of a file being copied over and a digital hit was introduced. So those are the types of things we're looking for from a qualitative perspective on the video side of things. You know, and on the audio, very similar types of qualitative issues where we're listening for, you know, a pop, a tick, a level dropping in a channel or a level missing or a channel getting reversed. From the objective, that's where we're looking at things like, you know, is it the correct codec? If they have a requirement for the bitrate, making sure those are set correctly, making sure the video levels using a Tektronix scope to make sure that they don't exceed certain levels. From the audio perspective, same thing, making sure the audio levels, you know, don't exceed a certain parameter based on a requirement that the studio, the content owner would have specified. So it is a combination of that visual, somebody's literally watching it, as well as putting it through different types of tools and scope to make sure it meets the requirements of, you know, whether it's the studio or the platform that it's going to be delivered to.
I'm thinking about this, and I'm thinking about if I were one of those people who was sitting there watching this movie, say, several times to make sure the audio's good and so I have to listen to every track and I have to watch this movie a bunch of times. How does that person avoid fatigue or, you know, just, you know, spacing out for a minute and missing a tick or something like, or, you know, some artifact that appears for a moment and then it's gone. But man, after the third or fourth or fifth time through this movie, you know, how can you keep your attention so focused?
Yeah, and that's really great. We have a great team of test engineers here, understanding the importance of every piece of content, you know, that they watch. It's not about enjoying the movie. It's about looking for any type of issue within the content, within the audio, within the subtitles that could result in a bad user experience. Understanding that, you know, you wouldn't want to go home and take a look at a piece of content and all of a sudden a frame breaks up or there's some corruption or something to that effect. So it's just keeping in mind the ultimate goal to ensure that whatever it is you're looking at is the best possible quality for that consumer in the home, which, you know, it could be you, it could be a relative, it could be a friend. So just always being spot on, paying attention to what you're seeing, not so much obviously following the story, but really looking at those technical aspects to make sure that everything's good.
That would be another problem for me is, you know, if you're following the story, you're going to be less likely to catch any little glitch or something. UJ is asking the same thing. I'm curious how you train 140 people. It's not all 140 in your company, but you have some suite of people. How do you train them to be able to uphold the standards? I would think one solution might be, if you're going to have to go through a movie several times, let several people do it for different runs, right? So one person would do the English Atmos track and one person would do the Spanish two-channel track or whatever. So that you don't have one person kind of just getting tired of the same content over and over again.
No, you're absolutely correct. We typically distribute the work across, you know, multiple test engineers, and it's required because as I had mentioned, not only are we testing content for all of the different audio languages, the different subtitle languages. In many cases, you know, let's take a Blu-ray disc, for example, you might have three or four versions of that same title because they're being shipped out into different territories or something for one of the online platforms that might be going to, you know, 10 different countries with multiple languages. So for some of these projects, we could be looking at, 15, 20 or more different audio streams and 30 or four different subtitles. So it's required for us to be able to distribute that work among, multiple test engineers, especially being, with the requirement of having to turn it around, very quickly and allow the studios to, remain within their production timelines, which are typically pretty tight.
Mm-hmm. Emily the Strange is asking, do you test for environmental effects like ambient lighting, for example? The other part of the question is, do you use different TV settings? I assume you calibrate all your TVs, and I'd love answer that. And also the possibility of using different cables. I wouldn't think that might be a big thing, but you tell me.
Well, actually, in regards to, talking about the cables, we make sure we always have it's a requirement to use, high-speed HDMI cables. That's needed to support the HDMI 2.0A protocol that's required for HDR content. If you don't have that, then you're going to the display is going to indicate that, the player would indicate that there's not an HDR display connected because it's the wrong type of cable. It can't carry the metadata. In regards to, environment, we keep our rooms, fairly dark, typically like in a 10 lux or darker viewing environment to ensure that the testers can, catch all of the possible video issues that might be there. The displays are all backlit also to help with the contrast. So there's a lot that goes into our viewing environment.
It's called bias lighting.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. So you set up your environment to be kind of optimal.
Correct.
And I think that's a good idea. And you mm-hmm. calibrate your TVs, right?
All of the displays we use for our testing are calibrated.
Right. that's an interesting question in and of itself. The high dynamic range calibration is not well defined yet. So how do you address that issue?
As you said, it's very new, so we typically work with the manufacturers to receive from them the best recommended settings from their point of view and make sure that those are enabled on all of the HDR displays.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned about HDMI cables, making sure that they're high speed. Isn't that a little bit of a misnomer? I mean, as long as the HDMI cable can carry 18 gigabits and all the all the end points of the connectors are connected to the right cables and properly and so on, it doesn't really matter. It's going to carry what it needs to carry, right? It's what's more important to me, and tell me if I'm wrong, is whether or not the output of the source device and the input of the display are both HDMI 2.0A, which is what you do need to carry metadata from HDR 10, and HDCP 2.2.
Yeah, in regards to the cables, if you think back, HDMI used to indicate the version number. Oh, this is a 1.2 cable, this is a 1.3, and then you have 1.3A, 1.3B, and people were having to throw cables out every time something new came out.
Yeah.
But they went away from that and they broke it down. I don't remember if it's five or six different types of HDMI cables. There's a HDMI standard, HDMI high speed. As long as you have that high speed cable, that will support everything required from, HDMI 2.0, 2.0A, and the HDCP 2.2. And that's the other component, is making sure that, to enable HDR across the whole chain, the whole ecosystem of the components that are involved there, that yes, your output device needs to support HDMI 2.0A, your display needs to support it. But if you're using some type of receiver within the chain, you need to make sure that that also supports HDMI mm-hmm. 2.0A, which is a little bit of a challenge too, because a lot of the, people have spent a lot of money on their AV receiver, and they may or may not support HDMI 2.0A. So you don't want to all of a sudden get this great new, playback device, this great new HDR display, 1,000 nits, have it go through the receiver that only does, HDMI 2.0, or it doesn't do HDCP 2.2. And the result is, you don't have HDR output, or in some cases, if it's not supporting HDCP 2.2, it might down-res the content to you to HD. But some of the manufacturers, for example, I don't know if you had a chance to look at the latest UHD Blu-ray players, they actually have two HDMI outputs. And the idea behind that is you have one that'll go straight into the display and one that'll go into your receiver, so that if your receiver doesn't support 2.0a or doesn't support HDCP 2.2, that's totally fine. You can take care of the best quality coming out of one of the HDMI outputs from the playback device and still get your HDR quality video by connecting the playback device directly to your display.
Right. And then the second HDMI output on the player, which the Samsung does have too, that goes to the AVR, and the AVR handles the audio only. It doesn't even deal with the video.
Correct.
Well, that leads to the question, do you have, you said you have consumer products in your testing facility. Do you have AVRs? Do you actually run things through AVRs as many consumers would do?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the majority of our testing, a lot of it goes through the AVRs, obviously for the HDR testing. Some of the receivers, we have a variety of different receivers. Some support 2.0a, some don't. You know, recently picked up a Yamaha, the 5100, which is capable of supporting all of that. So we can go straight through that to the display and get all of the latest and greatest, you know, HDR capabilities since it does support HDMI 2.0a and HDCP 2.2.
Mm-hmm. We should make it clear here at this point that there are two primary formats of HDR, high dynamic range. One is called HDR10. It's an open standard, and that's what's being used on Blu-ray, Ultra HD Blu-ray currently. And then there is Dolby Vision, which is a proprietary standard used, obviously developed by Dolby, and that is not currently on any Ultra HD Blu-ray discs, although it could be. It's allowed. HDR10 is required if you're going to do HDR at all, but it is available over streaming. And the other point I wanted to make was that HDMI 2.0a is required for HDR10 because HDR10 uses a particular type of metadata. Metadata being information about how the content was mastered and what it really needs to look its best and so on. That needs to be conveyed over HDMI, and it needs HDMI 2.0a. Dolby Vision also uses metadata, but they've done it a different way. And so you don't need HDMI 2.0a for Dolby Vision metadata. Dolby Vision can be carried in HDMI 1.4. So this is an interesting difference between those two systems. And I find it, but Dolby Vision is only used in streaming, and it's really only available on apps within the TV. And so all this HDMI business is irrelevant. It doesn't matter at this point in time. I assume you test both, right? You test Dolby Vision and HDR10.
Yeah, correct. And then in regards to, you know, your comment about the HDR10 and Blu-ray, the Blu-ray specification, you know, does provide for both the, you know, HDR10 or simply 2084, as it's more commonly referred to, as well as the Dolby Vision. And if you have a disc that is enabled with Dolby Vision, the simply 2084, the HDR10 is also a requirement. So you would end up with, you know, having both of those capabilities on the disc. But yes, on the display side of things, that's where you have, you know, again, the application is what would support that, you know, Dolby Vision capability. And as you probably saw, there's more displays now that are supporting that. Previously, we only had Vizio, but after CES, you saw TCL, LG, Hisense also announcing support for Dolby Vision. So you'll probably see that expand even further throughout the coming this year and beyond that as well.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, now we have several TVs, including the new Vizio P series, as well as the, I think all of the LG HDR sets can do both Dolby Vision and HDR10, which in my book is really the way to go, since I think both are going to coexist for a while. Not unlike, say, Dolby Digital and DTS Sound. Those are two different sound codecs, and they coexist. They're both there, and they have been for a long time. So I think we're going to see that a similar thing in HDR. We've got a couple of questions here in the chat room, but before we get to them, I'm going to take a moment to thank our other sponsor for this episode, which is Epson. Now, Epson's revolutionary EcoTank line of printers for home and office introduce a new age in printing. The new EcoTank ET4550 wireless all-in-one printer doesn't use ink cartridges. Instead, it features an innovative refillable ink tank. It comes with enough ink to print up to 11,000 black pages or 8,500 color pages, equivalent to about 50 ink cartridge sets. You're loaded and ready to print for up to 2 years. Powered by Epson's leading-edge precision core technology, it delivers high-speed, vivid colors, and laser-quality black text. Plus, auto two-sided printing, a 30-page auto document feeder, and easy wireless printing from tablets and smartphones. It's no wonder the ET4550 printer was named a CES 2016 Innovation Awards honoree. All EcoTank printers deliver an unbeatable combination of convenience and value with ultra-low-cost replacement ink bottles. Now you have the freedom to print without running out of ink. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank today to transform the way your home, office, or work group prints. For the best combination of ease and value, turn to the new Epson EcoTank printers. That's epson.com/EcoTank. And we thank Epson very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks. Epson, exceed your vision. So I got a couple of questions here from the chat room. Let's get to those. Helpless Corgis asks, and this may not apply to you directly, but how much input does the original director, director of photography, the sound person have on the end product, how the end product going to consumers, like on a Blu-ray or streaming, how much effect do they have on it? I would think they obviously have a lot, right?
I think a lot of that depends on the arrangements between the studio releasing it and the creator. In some cases, in a lot of cases, I know for a fact that as a product is being put on Blu-ray, one of the components is having it sent to them for, you know, review and approval. So they do get involved as part of it, making sure that everything is up to, you know, what they were expecting and that it meets their creative intent.
Now, do they get involved ever in the testing at your stage of things, or are they, I've signed off, it better be this way?
Yeah, that typically happens a little more upstream before it comes here. On our end, it's, okay, this is now, the approvals are done. Now it's coming to my eye for those final set of eyes to test it to make sure that it meets all of the requirements from the qualitative, the technical, et cetera, right before they go out and you know, mass produce the product.
Right. UJ is asking a very interesting question. How often does content fail? I'm not asking you to tell me about any particular piece of content, just, you know, is it most often, you know, 80-90% of the time everything's fine, or
there's always some little thing, you know, here and there that comes up that needs some form of correction. It could be something as simple as, you know, a subtitle being two frames out of sync, or it shifts up in a position, or there's a scene that comes in and for whatever reason the black level on the matte line changes, or the position of the matte line slightly changes. So there's always some,
what is the matte line
issue?
Oh, you mean the letterbox bar.
Exactly, on the bottom of the screen. So it's a variety of different, you know, types of issues we come across. And every now and then there's something odd. So I can't really label a percentage of, you know, fail. There's always something. And then it's, you know, at the discretion of, you know, the content owners. Is it something, you know, what is the issue? How significant? Do we want to fix it? But typically everybody, you know, works at the best of their abilities to make sure all issues are resolved before they make it out into the consumer marketplace.
Yeah. And then the next part of UJ's question is, if there is some problem and the content provider supplies a corrected version, does the testing start over from ground zero, or do you just make sure that one problem was corrected?
For something like that, it depends on the type of issue. In some cases, a correction might only require a spot check to make sure that that particular item was fixed. But in other cases, it would be a full test, from start to finish.
Mm-hmm. Beatmaster is asking if you're comfortable telling us what you have at home.
that's fine. I don't have a 4K HDR display. I do have Panasonic VT50 plasma. So right before
nice plasma,
the model, before they stopped making plasmas, I've got that with a really nice Yamaha receiver, some Polk Audio 5.1 surround system. So it's something I enjoy, something I have a lot of fun with.
Mm-hmm. Emily the Strange has another good question. In general, what is easier to catch, audio or video errors? And which one is more common?
I think the audio ones are easier to catch because it's something where, you know, no matter where you're looking, if a pop happens, you're going to hear the pop. The video, you could be looking at the top right, and then all of a sudden there's a slight glitch that happens on the bottom left. So they are a little bit more difficult to catch. But at the same time, if you think about it, for every audio stream, for every subtitle stream, if we're watching the content 20 different times, that's 20 times we get to review the video over and over to look at those types of issues.
Mm-hmm, that's a good point. And you may not catch it in one pass, but somebody else or the same person might catch it in the next pass.
Right.
Or five passes later or whatever. Yeah. Well, talking about audio, I would love to talk a minute about immersive audio. And we have, you mentioned at the beginning of the show that you have the facility to test for Dolby Atmos and DTS:X.
That's both correct,
Both of which are what we call immersive audio. So there's a set of speakers around you like a normal surround system, and then there are speakers overhead or above where the regular speakers are. And I'd love to ask you, first of all, how have you arranged your speakers to test for that? I assume you don't have two different facilities, one for one and one for the other, because Dolby has a pretty specific specification for where to put the overhead speakers, and DTS kind of doesn't.
Yeah, so we've kind of configured our rooms with we've had always the typical, 7.1 configuration, and, the addition of the immersive audio added four speakers essentially overhead above the area where the test engineer would sit, and that's what we've been using for the testing, whether it's the DTS:X or whether it is the Dolby Atmos, and it's, as we've found that to be very effective for both.
Mm. So you use one speaker layout and it works in both cases.
Right. For the testing, it allows us to identify issues in any of the 12 channels.
Mm. Mm-hmm. UJ in the chat room is asking about subtitles. How do you QC the accuracy of the translations? You have to have people who speak all these different languages.
We actually do in some cases. We have a lot of test engineers who are fluent in multiple languages, Japanese, Spanish, and several others, and they will QC not only the synchronization placement, but they'll QC the actual subtitle content itself to ensure that the spelling is correct, to ensure that between the feature, between any bonus material, what name and spelling they're using for a character in the feature is the same in the bonus material, so there's not any inconsistencies. We do that quite a bit, depending on the requirement of the content owner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that reminds me, not only does, with a Blu-ray disc anyway, or an Ultra HD Blu-ray disc or a DVD, not only do you have to look at the movie itself a bunch of times, but the bonus material, which can amount to hours and hours of content.
Oh, absolutely. And especially, on a big tentpole title, you have you could have multiple audio streams. You could have a director's track. You could have commentaries, multiple subtitle languages. So in many cases, there's more bonus material than there is feature material.
Yeah, exactly. And you mentioned multiple audio streams. Obviously, you have to listen to all those as well. But I'm also curious, getting back to immersive audio for a second, You know, you've got Atmos, you've got DTSX. If you have an Atmos or DTSX soundtrack on the disc, but of course not everybody has that kind of a speaker setup in their home theater. So I imagine you must listen for what's called down mixing, you know, to make sure that everything's in the normal 5.1 or 7.1.
Right. Absolutely. So we'll do obviously that initial test with the full capabilities of the content. You know, typically it's, you know, 7.1.4, and then we'll play that same content in like a 5.1 configuration just to ensure that, you know, all of the material is still there and nothing gets dropped.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Tell me a little bit more about, other kinds of problems that might crop up. When we were talking offline before the show, you mentioned compression artifacts, and there are different problems, say, with mezzanine files, which we were talking about earlier, as opposed to consumer files that an end user would end up getting. What sort of issues can crop up, and what kind of different issues are there between those two?
Yeah, with the mezzanine files, those are, you know, pretty far upstream. I mean, that's the initial file before it goes through the production process. You know, especially around, you know, we'll talk a little bit about HDR and, you know, the metadata, making sure everything is mapped correctly. I mean, some of the strangest issues we come across typically at that level would be things where you have a fluctuation in the color or the luminance, you know, within a scene. You know, somebody's got a red sweater and all of a sudden the color of the red changes because there was an issue with the way the metadata and such was mapped. It's often definitely correctable, but these are some of the types of things that you see when you're testing at the mezzanine level that you don't typically come across, you know, downstream.
Well, except that if that problem that you mentioned as an example, say somebody's wearing a red sweater and the color changes in the middle of the scene, if you don't fix that in the mezzanine level, won't that occur then in the final consumer deliverable?
Yeah, it absolutely could. And that's why the QC that we perform at the mezzanine level is, I mean, it's all important, but, you know, we make sure we have our golden eyes really looking very, very closely at the mezzanines.
Golden eyes. So your test engineers are considered golden eyes?
Absolutely.
You know, there are people in Hollywood, you know, who have golden eyes, and you can really, you know, they can see something right away that most other people won't see. And I guess that's another question, isn't it? You know, if you're testing, I mean, I think it makes sense that you would test with golden eye people who are trained. And I want to ask you about training. That's another good question. Who are trained to see little tiny imperfections that most of us wouldn't see. You know, sort of why does it matter if the vast majority of people wouldn't even notice?
Well, it's interesting to see as, you know, new staff come on board and are trained, you can kind of see areas of specialty with different people. Somebody might be very good with audio. Somebody might be better with video. And then just kind of, as you see their areas of expertise, you kind of gear them more towards, you know, those particular areas so they can continue to develop those skills, whether it's I'm more of the video person or I'm more of an audio person and, you know, taking advantage of those capabilities.
Yeah. So what's involved in training your quality control engineers?
Well, a lot of it has to do with, you know, first making sure they understand, you know, what is the goal, what is the purpose of what we do, having them understand that, having them sit with test engineers to kind of see what exactly it is, you know, we're doing, taking a look at previously identified issues so that they understand the types of issues to look for, so that they are completely clear of what's expected in the content, as well as what are some of the types of issues that could occur. Because typically a lot of these issues are like, oh, I wouldn't have expected for something like that to be able to occur. But it, you know, these types of things do. So it's making sure that we provide them with the tools and information that they need to identify any type of issue that could or has already existed or maybe hasn't come up yet, as of yet, but could.
Well, that's good. So do you have like clips of blatantly bad something going wrong that you can show them and say, look, here's a really bad example of, you know, MPEG compression macro blocking, for example.
Yeah, or something like that. Here's a compression artifact. Here is, you know, banding. Here's some tearing. Here is the macro blocking, you know, mosquitoing. Here's a digital hit, or here's some audio that has a tick or a pop, or this channel is all of a sudden drops out for, you know, a few seconds, things like that.
Right. So you have examples of all of those that you play to these people to say, this is what you're looking for and what we want to try and correct.
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, good. Radio Rod is asking a question that really doesn't have to do with what you do, but we can talk about it for a sec, which is he's saying that The Martian was shown in Dolby Atmos, had Dolby Atmos soundtrack in certain theaters, including the Dolby Cinema up the street from us. And the question is that the Blu-rays do not have Atmos. They only have 5.1 or 7.1. I forget which. There's no Atmos. Why no Atmos? Now, that's not your decision. That's the studio's decision.
Yeah, absolutely. That's completely up to the studio and what they decide, what arrangements they make. And there's a multitude of reasons, I'm sure, as to why they make those types of decisions. But ultimately, it is at that level.
Yeah, I'm bummed about that myself. You know, I wish the studios would, if they made an Atmos soundtrack for the commercial cinema, I really want that to be on the Blu-ray or the Ultra HD Blu-ray, but in some cases, it simply isn't, and that's the studio's choice, and it's up to us as consumers to write them angry letters and say, put Atmos back in. If you have an Atmos soundtrack, use it. It's already there. You've already done it.
Isn't that why they invented the special edition?
Yes, indeed. Exactly. Okay. User 5286 is asking about down converting Atmos from a 5.1.4 or 7.1.4 down to 5.1. That has got to be the responsibility for that rests mostly on the receiver.
Yeah, absolutely. So in order to test that, we will test that content on a receiver that does not support the Atmos or does not support the DTS:X.
It would be a receiver. You will test it on a system that doesn't support it.
Right, correct.
To see what happens. Oh, that's that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that. So you must test then on a variety of different receivers.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We have receivers that, again, support Atmos and DTS:X. Those that just support Dolby True HD or DTS HD Master Audio, and we test it on a variety.
User 5286, for those of you who are concerned about Atmos not being on The Martian and other Blu-rays, start a change.org petition. I'll sign that one. Well, we've had a really interesting time here talking about testing content, making sure that what gets delivered to consumers is as good as it can possibly be. I myself was a quality control engineer, not in this field, but in an electronics company, and I would test resistors and stuff. And so I know, you know, that it's a very important function, and what you guys do there is really important to those of us who are home theater geeks and want the best possible quality coming into our home by either physical disc or streaming. I imagine you're probably doing a lot of streaming these days, huh?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. For, you know, one of our, you know, our clients, we do a lot of work, like I said, with Netflix. We are a Netflix preferred vendor. And as part of that, we do a lot of the streaming QC. So the majority of the material that's available on Netflix it goes through our testing facility and our testing engineer. So we will review it and test it, the audio, the video, before it actually gets released out into the consumers.
And you're doing that with HDR content from Netflix as well, right?
Correct.
Because they have Marco Polo. I think Daredevil is coming up. I don't remember what else. Can you say any other titles that they have in HDR?
I really can't comment to that, but...
All right. Can't blame a guy for trying. Well, listen, it's been a fascinating hour, and I want to thank you very much for being here. That's Juan Reyes, Chief Innovation Officer at MyEyeMedia, talking about testing content to make sure it's great. Thanks, Juan.
Thanks a lot, Scott. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
You bet. I really appreciate it. You can get more information about what Juan's company does at myeyemedia.com. That's M-Y-E-Y-E media.com. You can always find me at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott and at avsforum. You can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/htg and on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twit/home-theater-geeks. Now, next week is a very special episode of Home Theater Geeks. It is our 300th episode. Joining me to celebrate is none other than the chief twit himself, Leo Laporte, and Dick DiBartolo, the Giz Whiz. So we're going to have a lot of fun talking about the last 6+ years of Home Theater Geeks. And we certainly will involve the chat room very deeply as well. So I hope you will all join us and chime in the chat room for episode number 300. And we do hope you will join us for that. Until then, geek out.